From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, call us now at 800-462-7413. And Zorba, along with our call, some interesting topics to talk over.
Yes, so we're going to discuss a couple of topics. One of these is real. Scientists localize the Christmas holiday spirit in the brain. Mm-hmm. Scary movies can really curdle blood.
Yep.
Study finds Americans really do not have better teeth than the English. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what's the other one?
And the FDA warns about powdered caffeine and issues with powdered caffeine that really can be toxic, and some very important issues that I think we all have to sort of put our ears up and think about. It's a problem ready to occur.
No powdered caffeine in our recipe.
Not at all. Multigrain B&B pancakes. It's breakfast all day long on public radio.
Sounds good to me. 800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, to Spokane, Washington we go. Hi.
Hello.
Yeah, what's up?
Well, I'm calling about trigger finger, or in my case, trigger finger, because I've had it both in my left thumb and my right baby finger. I've had shots of cortisone in each to take care of it. I've had two shots in my thumb, and my doctor says I can't have another one. I got to go to the surgery.
Uh-huh.
So my question is there any other way to cure it other than the steroid shots or in surgery, and is there any way to prevent it?
Yeah, we've talked about this before, and I don't remember what trigger finger is. Can you explain it to me?
It's awfully sore. It hurts. Like in my thumb, all of a sudden it just started catching at the joint.
That's exactly
where my thumb bends.
Right. Yeah.
And I thought I'd been skiing the day before, and it was the only time I got to ski last year because of the crummy snow.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, maybe that had something to do with it, and it'd go away. But holy smokes, it didn't, and it just continued to get worse.
So you can't straighten out your finger, or you can't bend it?
Well, you can't bend it. I mean, there's a catch. You can bend it, but, man, it's really painful when it bends. It, like, snaps.
That's right. It snaps. It pops like a trigger. That's exactly where it comes from. And basically, it's because of swelling within the tendons going over other tendons, and you've got to get the swelling over the tendon. You could sort of think of them as one tendon is horizontal and one tendon is vertical, and basically one has to slide over another, and when it's inflamed, it doesn't do it. And a cortisone shot or two are okay, but if we give numerous cortisone shots, then you can actually weaken the tendon, and you don't want to do that. And so the treatment basically is to go in there, open up, you know, the tendon that's blocking the other tendon. So basically the finger, the thumb, you know, as you said, your finger and your thumb can both move well. So are there things you can do besides surgery and cortisone shots? The long answer is no, and the short answer is no. Both the long answer and the short answer. Well, there is another answer. Live with it and don't do anything.
It should be the short answer is no, and the long answer is no.
It's hard to live with, though. It almost becomes debilitating after a while.
It does, because it hurts so much. It hurts so much. So, and I've had trigger finger. I've had a couple of injections, and if it happens again, I'm headed off to the surgeon just like you are. And it is bothersome. I've got a very, very good friend, Ben Sidrin, who's a jazz pianist. He had a trigger finger, had an injection. It worked for a while. And then when the second injection, I think he had a second injection, didn't work, he ended up having surgery. And he plays the piano really, really well. And you'll play the piano well, too, after you have this fixed. You'll be a world-famous jazz musician when you have this fixed. But, yeah, I would pick the time to have it done, and I would have it done because it is painful. It's uncomfortable, and like you said, it interferes with lifestyle. You know, when you're skiing, with my trigger finger, I would ski, and then I would open up my fingers, and it would be ouch. You know, it would be very painful when I would let go of my pole. I'd be on the chairlift.
So should I wait till, like, I can feel it? coming back in my thumb right now. I mean, it's not bad yet, but I think it's coming back. Should I wait for it to get all the way back and then have the surgery?
I would go and see the surgeon. That's what I would do. And I would just pick a time and decide when I want to have it do it. You know, when I would want to do it. Yeah, I would.
Well,
I would make an appointment with a surgeon and pick one who does them. You know, there are a lot of surgeons that do them, and they're a common procedure.
There's no way to prevent it. My doctor just says it's old age because I'm getting old. And
we're all getting old. Even the young people are getting old.
Well,
you know,
that's the
way life goes. You know,
what he says too.
Yeah, it's just it's one of those things. But hey, you're still skiing, right? You know.
Yeah, if we ever get snow again out here, I'd love to.
Get thee to the surgeon and have it done at your convenience. The answer is your doctor is right. It is an aging phenomena. Babies do not have trigger fingers, and you ain't no baby.
I ain't no baby, that's for sure.
Thanks a lot for the call. Yeah. All you old coots, I hope you're going to be okay.
But it's not just old. People get this in their 30s and 40s.
Yeah.
It's not just an age phenomena. People do not often get trigger finger when they're younger, but this is a common problem in the 30s. Would you call 30 old?
Of course not.
How about 40?
No.
How about 50?
No.
How about 60?
No.
How about 70?
No.
How about 80?
No.
It's a relative term. As I always say, old age is 25 years older than you are today.
Yeah. Now, Zorba, you mentioned, we always do research about this time in the program.
Yes, we do.
And you mentioned three different studies.
Yeah, that's right. There are three studies. Tom, you now have to guess which study is real, okay? These are studies from
British. We're going to talk about not real research?
Well, you're going to guess. Some of them are fake. They always say some fake and real studies.
Okay.
The first one is this. You got to vote on this. Scientists localize the Christmas spirit in the brain. You don't tell whether it's real or not real until
I'm so scientists
localize the Christmas spirit
in the brain.
Okay. Number two, scary movies can really curdle blood. Okay. Scary movies can really curdle blood.
Okay.
And number three, study finds Americans do not have better teeth than the English. Okay, that's number three. Study finds Americans do not have better teeth than the English. Which of these is real? The Christmas spirit, the curdling blood, or the teeth? Which one is real?
Well, it's pretty obvious which one is real.
Okay, go ahead and tell me which one is real.
Number one.
Yeah. Well, it turns out that is number one. You know something? Nothing gets past you. This was a study where they took
curdling blood makes a little sense.
That makes little sense.
I'm not sure about that. You mentioned the Brits' teeth.
That's
and
right.
A lot of Brits don't like you talking
that's
about
right.
it, by
they
the
don't.
Way.
They don't like me talking about it, but they need more dentists in Great Britain. That's right. And they need to floor.
I think that's so wrong. I don't believe that for a second.
They need to fluoridate.
I don't believe that for a second.
They need to fluoridate. Moving right along. So the Christmas spirit, as you know, is a widespread phenomenon. But there are people who have what the BMJ calls the Bah Humbug Syndrome.
Okay.
Of Bah Humbug Christmas. They don't care about it. So they took 20 people, 10 participants who celebrated Christmas, and 10 participants who said Bah Humbug.
Okay.
They put them in an MRI scanner. Okay, this is a functional MRI scanner that looks at flow in the brain. And they gave them beautiful scenes of Christmas jolly and Christmas spirit and children happy with toys and, you know, and you know, things that would make normal people happy. And they took people who had spirit and Christmas spirit, and then they took Bah Humbug Scrooge-like people that said Bah Humbug. This is just like any other time of the year, to see whether or not there was a difference in parts of their brain, you know, that lit up, and lo and behold.
And they found differences.
Absolutely. They found the left and right parietal regions, which we know are very important in terms of emotion, played a role. They play a role in how we feel about life. They play a role in personality. They also appear to play a role in whether or not people tend towards spirituality.
Oh.
And lo and behold, they found that the people who celebrated Christmas had more blood flow to this part of the brain than people who said Bah Humbug. So indeed, there may be an actual physical reason why some people celebrate Christmas and other people say Bah Humbug.
Yeah, although it isn't clear what the cause and effect is.
Of course not.
Maybe the people who don't celebrate they don't celebrate.
That's right. That's exactly it. We don't know the cause and effect.
Yeah.
But it might be that Scrooge actually had an anomaly in his brain, which explains why he celebrated Christmas. Didn't celebrate Christmas. Of course, at the end, he did. He overcame his deficiency in the right and left parietal lobe and bought a turkey for Tiny Tim and saved the Christmas spirit for the rest of us.
I'd still like to see the study on scary movies and blood-curdling.
Well, I think that study is long in the tooth, so we'll see what happens with that.
800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. And our next caller, Zorba, is listening in New York City. Hi.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
Well, I'm going to give you a little background first. I had congestive heart failure in 1997, and eventually they had to put a pacemaker in about a year later. About 5 years ago, because of a botched-up operation, I'm on Coumadin, they didn't do the INR properly, and I started bleeding, and I went into a coma. They put me in a coma for 11 days.
Gee.
I had sepsis, pneumonia, kidney and liver failure, and
you're a miracle. I mean, it's a miracle that you're alive.
Yes, my cardiologist said I'm a miracle too. And she said if we save 5%, we consider they are miracles.
Right, right. With that, that's exactly right. With that sort of problem. So you're
right.
Yeah. You're a living.
So I did rehab, and I'm fine now. But anyway, the problem now is about the end of the summer. I started getting this pain, sort of from my waist to my underarm. On the side of me, not by the chest.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept telling my doctor, and finally he said, we'll get an x-ray. The x-ray didn't show anything.
Mm-hmm.
Then I was scheduled for a lot of heart stuff anyway, so I had a nuclear test, an echocardiogram. And after I had that, about a week later, I started feeling very sluggish.
Mm-hmm.
Just didn't want to get out of bed. And one morning I woke up, the pressure on my chest was so great, I knew it was something. And I went to the emergency room, and they checked me in. Turned out I had fluid in my lung.
Mm-hmm.
So they did all the tests, no heart attack, mm-hmm. my heart's fine, but so they just put me on Lasix.
Mm-hmm.
I went to see my cardiologist the next morning, and she said, well, we can treat the symptom, but we just don't know the cause.
Mm-hmm.
And then about 3 days later, I got a norovirus, and I was out of commission for about...
you know something? You're a medical miracle from from start to finish.
Right. So then, I'm 74, so it took a long time to get over that. I think this is the first day I felt alive.
Uh-huh.
And what I'm wondering is, what could have caused the fluid in the lung?
Uh-huh. First of all, let me tell you, sometimes we don't understand things at all. For instance, we don't understand why you survived. I mean, you were in a terrible situation. 5% survive, and why were you one of the 5%? Who knows? You know, I mean, you obviously had good medical care, or you would have died, that's mm-hmm. for sure. But a lot of people who have sepsis and have, you know, as you say, a botched operation, a whole bunch of other things, just die from it. And some of that is luck. I mean, some of it we can define because we know that there are a variety of things, but there are other things that we can't define that are random within our body. Okay, so I want to just put that out. There's randomness within our body that we can't define. I'm not going to get onto the angel discussion. I'm going to get onto the randomness discussion mm-hmm. from a scientist because I'm a scientist. So at this point, they don't know why you had fluid in your lungs. That's about where it sits. In other words, at this point, they don't know. They look to see if it was heart failure. And with an echocardiogram and other tests, a nuclear cardiac test, they can pretty much tell if this is from heart failure. So they looked at that. If it were sepsis, if it were an infection, you would have been sick. You would have been ill. You would have brought a purulent, yucky sputum. You probably would have had a fever and chills and an elevated white count. So it wasn't that. And they gave you a water pill, which took away the fluid that was in your lungs?
Yes, and the pressure isn't there.
You may just have heart failure for another reason, because you're older and your cardiac condition has been compromised during the sepsis and other things. A pacemaker took care of it in 1997. You know, when you had it in 98, it improved it. But you may have just had a little heart failure now. It's a tenable diagnosis. Doesn't mean it is, but it's a tenable diagnosis. And so you could have mild heart failure, and it may not come back if you stay on the furosemide. That's what I would guess.
All right.
It is a guess, you know. But
we so even like, we just don't know why you had that.
Right. And, you know, that's, I'll tell you something, that is the hardest thing right now in modern medicine that people have to believe. The hardest thing for is to say, we don't know why, but you're better. And that's very disconcerting. You know, if your doctor said, well, we know it was for this reason, this test was abnormal, that test was abnormal, that's the cause for this, take the Lasix, you would feel better, right? Versus, well, we gave the Lasix and it got better, we don't know why. You know, that's not as comforting. But, you know, science is messy. You know, it's fits and starts, and you're a modern miracle because you made it through, and that was quite a thing to go through for just an eyelid. Did you have ptosis, that drooping of the eye?
Yes.
Yeah, and so, you know, a lot of people have to have that particular surgery. You are one lucky fella.
I know I am. You are. And my friends all say I have more than 9 lives. I won't go into it, but I've had many, many incidents over 70
years. Yes,
yes.
Well, you walk on the right side of the street. Thank you.
Sure.
You're welcome.
We appreciate the call. Thanks a lot at 800-462-7413. I think I'd rather hear, we don't know why you got better, than we don't know why you got worse.
That's right. Got it. That's right. We don't know why you're failing. That's right. Much better to say we don't know why you got better, but we'll stick with it. You got
Before
it.
We take a quick break, Zorba, let's hear from your favorite backseat drivers, the Grammar Police. Today's quibble comes to us from a listener, Larry in Minnesota, who, for all intents and purposes, we're going to call the Salt Police. He writes, Dear Dr. Zorba, I'm wondering if you misspoke regarding the amount of sodium needed on a recent show. You said that normally people need about 1.5 teaspoons of salt per day. My calculations show that 1.5 teaspoons of salt contains about 3,500 milligrams of sodium. Most experts recommend that healthy adults should limit sodium intake to 2,300 milligrams per day, and adults with high blood pressure should limit it to 1,500 milligrams per day. I'm wondering if you meant to say 1.5 grams instead of 1.5 teaspoons.
The answer is yes. That's exactly right. The general recommendations are about 2,300 milligrams a day for people under the age of 50 and about 1,500 milligrams for people over the age of 50. You know, the issue about salt limitation is quite interesting. We used to be very, very rigid about salt, and then we discovered that our patients were not as rigid about salt as we were. And so the recommendations I give to my patients are read those labels, because you'll find out, especially in prepared foods, that there is a tremendous amount of salt that you never think you're getting. And what you want to do is, when you're looking towards salt limitation, it's the prepared foods, soups, other things that you can get that are made with too much salt. Limit it that way. But the answer is yes. 1,500 milligrams if you're over 50, about 2,300 milligrams if you're under the age of 50.
Well, we appreciate the Grammar Police on this and the correction, but I don't have a clue as to how many grams or teaspoon or any other thing of salt that I have in a day.
Well,
I bet you most people don't
know.
Yeah,
that's exactly. Well, so the answer is...
You have to read all the labels.
But the answer is this. Nobody's going to read the labels. Unless you have OCD, unless you're really obsessive, you don't read all those labels. So the answer is less prepared food has less salt. When you're cooking, do not put salt in, but put salt on top of the food after you cook it, and you will have less salt. And when you go out and you decide you're going to go out to eat, try to pick entries that just have less salt in them. And, you know, it's just, I think it's a matter of being reasonably vigilant versus obsessive compulsive. Because for most people, they're not going to do that.
It's kind of a good idea to have as little salt as
possible. Yeah, because we have too much salt. The average American gets something like 4,000 to 5,000 milligrams of salt a day, which is about 2 to 3 times as much as you need.
Are you salty about something Zorba said?
Oh, I love it.
Join the ever-growing Grammar Police Force and send your grievances along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org, or don't forget Facebook.
We are on the cusp of our recipe. You'll want to stay with us for that. More of your calls, of course, some more interesting emails too, and more interesting research to talk about right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. We'll be right back.
Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. If you have a question for Zorba, the number is 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, multi-grain B&B pancakes.
Do you like pancakes?
Yeah.
Now, that was kind of a qualified, yeah. It wasn't like, it was, yes,
it was
I like pancakes.
It was intentional, the qualification.
You mean it was
I haven't had pancakes in 5 years. Probably.
Why not? How could you not have had pancakes
because
in 5 years?
Because I like
years?
Them all right, but I like every other breakfast thing better.
But you like breakfast. Breakfast.
Oh, yeah,
you like
I love
to go
breakfast.
Out for breakfast.
I like
how
eggs.
About how about waffles?
Waffles are a little better than pancakes. Little,
when was the last time you had waffles?
Maybe 3 years ago.
3 years ago, that's right. How about eggs?
Eggs, yes.
Yeah, eggs, yes. Okay. I happen to like pancakes. I like waffles. I like pancakes. Mm. But I usually, I mean, I don't just have them on a Sunday. I have them on a Sunday when I have company. Mm-hmm. That's what I have. But this is a multigrain. So this is a little bit better. Pancakes are not what you call a health food.
I think we'll That's call the
it
truth.
That's it. Okay. Start out with 1/2 cup of flour, all-purpose flour.
1/2 cup of flour.
1/4 cup of whole wheat flour. We've got white flour and whole wheat flour.
Why two different kinds
well,
of flour?
If you only had whole wheat flour, they would never rise. I mean, if it's only whole wheat flour, they won't rise. Oh. They'll be dead as a doornail. They'll be okay for backpacker camping, but not for celebration. 1/4 cup of quick oatmeal.
1/4 cup quick oatmeal.
3 tablespoonfuls of cornmeal.
3 big tea cornmeal.
2 tablespoonfuls of wheat germ.
2 big tea wheat germ.
You have wheat germ around the house?
No.
Just asking.
That we don't make pancakes.
That was definitive. Yeah. 2 teaspoons of baking powder.
2 little tea baking powder.
By the way, baking powder is a wonderful thing. I made matzo balls the other day, and I added some baking powder to it, and they were so fluffy.
Oh, good.
Baking powder really makes things fluffy.
I'm happy
That's another
for
recipe.
You.
Thank you. Thank you. 1/4 teaspoon of salt.
1/4 little tea salt. How many milligrams
I'm not translating this into milligrams. That's exactly it.
Okay.
2 teaspoons of sugar.
2 little tea sugar.
You know, when I read some recipes and they give it in metric, it's like Greek. I mean, I look at metric, you know, so many grams of this, I can't figure that out. 1 cup of skim milk.
1 cup of skim milk.
And if you don't have skim milk, you could use whatever milk you have around the house. I had a cup of whole milk the other day. It was like cream.
I know.
It tasted, it was delicious.
Wow.
It was like delicious. I could feel my coronary arteries just spasm as I was drinking it. Moving along, 2 tablespoons of canola oil.
2 big tea canola oil.
1 large egg beaten.
1 large egg beaten.
1/2 cup of fresh blueberries.
1/2 cup of fresh blueberries.
1/2 cup of fresh strawberries.
1/2 cup of fresh strawberries.
You like berries, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I like berries. They're good. Okay, so let's make the recipe. First of all, you're going to combine the dry ingredients, the flours, the whole wheat flour and the all-purpose flour, oatmeal, cornmeal, wheat germ, baking powder, salt, and sugar. Combine them together. Then stir in the milk, oil, and egg and mix it well. Okay, so you now have your batter. By the way, when you mix it, you can keep it lumpy. It actually will turn out better if it's lumpy versus totally consistent.
Oh, really?
But you knew that, right?
Yeah. Not until 4 seconds ago.
4 seconds ago, exactly. And then pour 1/4 cup of batter for each pancake on a 400-degree griddle. Now, I have finally improved my pancakes by buying an electric griddle with a thermostat on it, and I move it up to 400 degrees. Because I discovered that what happened is I would heat the frying pan, and I wouldn't wait long enough. And with the griddle, I just put it on. They don't cost very much at all. And when I'm going to make pancakes, I pull out the griddle. It makes a better pancake.
Got it.
I recommend anyone who likes pancakes buy an electric griddle.
Mm-hmm.
So pour 1/4 cup of batter for each pancake into a 400-degree griddle. Cook roughly 2 minutes on each side until the pancakes are golden brown. Turn around. You know, the edges should be dry. You know how to make a pancake. Everybody, even Tom, right, knows how to make a pancake.
I don't have a clue.
Everyone except Tom knows how to make a pancake.
I'm getting information right now.
And then, right, you're learning. You're learning. Then top the pancakes with some blueberries and raspberries. Pull out some wonderful maple syrup. I've got maple syrup that a patient gives me every year, and it tastes smoky. It's just delicious. Sit down, maybe with a nice hot cup of coffee. Read the Sunday newspaper and enjoy these multi-grain B&B pancakes.
They do sound good.
And like I said, Each pancake has 112 calories. 33% of the calories are coming from fat. Do not think that pancakes are a health food, because if you will, you will be wrong. Yeah. They are simply a delicious, wonderful food to enjoy.
Now, I was goofing around so much, I didn't catch all of that. How can I find out?
You know, you can do it through a modern appliance called a smartphone or through a computer. Go to our website, ZorbaPastor.org. Look at those recipes. Look at pictures of Tom and me and find some other wonderful recipes. That's ZorbaPastor.org, or find us on Facebook.
800-462-7413, the number if you have a question for Zorba. 800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, to Brilliant, Wisconsin we go. Hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call, guys. I appreciate your time and attention.
Sure. How can we help?
Well, I'm a 35-year-old guy with a otherwise perfectly boring health history, and my blood pressure has been a problem for me for not so long now, about 2 years that I've known. About a year and a half ago, my health insurance company plays this little game where we get a rebate at the end of the year if we meet certain benchmarks in our physical. And a year and a half ago, I was just a fuzz high on my blood pressure. It didn't cause me much alarm, and I went about my life and came back a year later, and my blood pressure was kind of alarmingly high.
What was it?
At that time, I think they measured me in the office at like 152 over 100 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that caused me some anxiety. I checked it regularly after that, and it was routinely pretty high. I started having sort of, I think probably imagined chest pains or anxiety chest pains.
Mm-hmm.
I had a stress test and an EGD done and several other things. They're trying to figure me out. And it turns out I think it was just a lot of anxiety. So anyway, about 4 months ago, I decided that I was going to check it regularly. So I actually started measuring it twice a day. I bought sort of a mid-range home monitor, checking it twice a day. And for the first time since I was actually in a former life an athlete, I started exercising routinely, even though I had what I think is a pretty active lifestyle up until that point. I didn't have scheduled exercise. And so I've been working at this now for about 4 months, and I've gotten to the point where I'm not anxious about it anymore. I know what my blood pressure is. It's actually not that bad, but I can't get it to come down. It just doesn't come down. Yeah. And no matter what I do, I can't get it. It's steady.
You're taking a statin or no?
No, I'm not taking anything. They almost put me on metoprolol, which is an alpha blocker, I think. But I wasn't. After I had my stress test, they decided not to go that route. Okay. And so I've just been trying to monitor myself and take care of it. And if you go on the internet and search, you know, like how to control your blood pressure, the top 10 things, I am on it, like every one of them.
So let's talk about a few things. First of all, you may have high blood pressure, and we treat high blood pressure with medicines when lifestyle doesn't work, and they're very effective. We have dropped stroke by 80%, and stroke is mainly caused by high blood pressure, over the last three decades. 80% is phenomenal. We're anywhere near a cure rate for cancer like that. And so we have to look at that issue, first of all. So what's your height? What's your weight?
I'm 6'4 and 185 pounds.
Okay, so you're not overweight. I don't have a BMI table, but I know
6'4. No, I'm nearly underweight.
Yeah. You're not on that scale. And you said you were an athlete in the past. What sort of stuff did you do?
I was a track athlete, and I played basketball, and I played lacrosse for a little while in college.
Okay. So you're an athlete, you do the right stuff, and then you looked at lifestyle changes, alcohol, sodium, you know, weight is not an issue. And what's your blood pressure running now?
The average is 131 over 82, which isn't so bad. But,
actually, 131 over 82 is fine. It's not that it's not so bad. 131 over 82, we don't treat blood pressure that's 131 over 82. I mean, that's an okay number.
I think that I'm a science guy.
Yeah.
So I calculated standard deviation. I have a standard deviation of 10, though, on my systolic, and it gets up. It gets up over 140 routinely, and my diastolic is over 90 at least once a week.
So let's look at that because I think that's really an important issue. When we look at treatment of high blood pressure, we look at averages. We do look at a standard deviation, but that's not the way what has proven to work well. What's proven to work well is basically what the average blood pressure is. And if the blood pressure is high normal, the question is whether or not you treat it. If it's abnormal, 140 over 90, we definitely treat it. And And if lifestyle doesn't work, and it appears that it may not be working in your case, like you say, what you want to do, just to go back a step, is you want to reduce the anxiety component. And when people have what we call white coat hypertension, they go into the doctor's office, their pressure goes up. One of the ways to measure it is to get a home monitor, and good one, mid-range monitor is good. You paid, what, $50 or something like that for your monitor?
Yep.
$50, it's a good monitor. They've improved them. And if the numbers still are high, if you were my patient, and if it were me, I would take a pill. That's what I would do. I would say, I want to treat it. I want the pressure to be lower. I want to be on a medicine. And I would choose one of several medicines, either a very low dose of hydrochlorothiazide, which is a very old pill that has known effects. We don't use it for the diuretic effect, even though it's in the diuretic class. And I would take a teeny tiny dose of 12.5 milligrams and see if that worked. And if it worked, I would stay on it. And why do you have it? We don't know. Some people have it. Some people have high blood pressure, even regardless of their lifestyle. For me, from my point of view, I think if you look at the data, you're a science guy, go to the JNC8, I can't remember, Joint National Committee on Hypertension, and we're either in number 7 or number 8. I can't keep track of it. You read the latest results on blood pressure, and I think the balance of information says we treat it. And the earlier we treat it, the better off we are. And even though you don't like the idea in your 30s that you actually may need to be on a pill, if you have done everything you can by lifestyle, you may still just have the genetic makeup to have high blood pressure. And the answer is then you treat it with a minimal pill that does the minimal amount. Now, a beta blocker they may have given you because it can also affect anxiety. It's useful for anxiety. But I think if you're no longer anxious about it, the beta blocker is not the way to go. I would do a tiny dose of a diuretic, maybe even 6.25 of hydrochlorothiazide or 12.5, and that may be enough to keep those high numbers from going over the border.
Sure. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Yeah,
appreciate the call at 800-462-7413.
You know, the issue is quite interesting. It's not an uncommon issue. It's a common issue. People will say, wait, I have high blood pressure, or I have high cholesterol, and I'm following the cardboard diet, and I don't have any salt, and I'm eating right, and I'm at the right weight. Why do I still have high cholesterol or high blood pressure? The answer is genes. I mean, we're born, you know, you can't choose your parents, and you're born with a certain genetic predisposition. Lifestyle can modulate it, but genes are there. And if you've got a disease such as high blood pressure, we know that when we treat it, we reduce the risk of stroke tremendously. Yes. And this is a good example.
I said statin. I take it. It's not for blood pressure, though.
Yeah,
but
that was a good question because that would be another question, whether or not he was on a statin, whether or not he also had cholesterol, because that can be a risk factor in high blood pressure. So, Tom, that was a good pickup.
Thanks for bailing me out. 800-462-7413. That's 800-462.
I can't get away with anything, can I?
800-462-7413. And before the break, Zorba, let's take an email question from a listener named Ginny. She writes, "Dear Dr. Zorba, I have a concern. We live in northern Wisconsin and get our prescription drugs through the mail. Is there any danger in extreme weather to our drugs, as in freezing temperatures or very warm and humid days?"
No, the answer is yes. That really is an issue. And you bring up an interesting point. So first of all, you know, when it's traveling in the trucks, how cold does it get in the trucks? I don't know the answer to that, but there are some drugs that have to be kept at room temperature within a certain temperature within it. Now, when we have medications that come to our office that we're giving to patients, they come with a thermometer that has a telltale, it's called, and basically the high and low of the drug shipment is right on there, so you can tell if the drug shipment was low or if the drug shipment was high. And I know that our pharmacy has that too, so when the drugs come to the pharmacy, they have a telltale, and if it's off the telltale, in other words, too high or too low, they often will not accept the shipment. But when it comes to getting the drugs through the mail, I have never thought about
that. That's a very good question.
It's a very good question, and it may be that some people are are not treated to Goel because the drugs they're getting through the mail, let's say they live in Bemidji, Minnesota, are sitting in the truck and are freezing because they're in the truck or they're sitting in the mailbox.
She's in northern Wisconsin, so
forget the truck. They're sitting in the mailbox. You know, the mail gets delivered, we'll say, at 10 o'clock in the morning, and you get home at 6 o'clock at night, and I don't know about you, but my mailbox is not heated. And so anything in the mailbox is going to go to freezing. She brings up an important point. You know, the answer is she has to call up where she gets the drug from. She has to talk to them and say, are any of my drugs, especially if you're living in northern Wisconsin, are any of my drugs, if they freeze, are the drugs then inactivated and not safe? In which case, she can't get the drugs through the mail.
Yeah.
And she has to discuss that with her insurance company.
Interesting. Have a question for the good doc? Zorba's here to help. Just post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Some interesting research to talk about. That's coming up next. More of your questions, of course. Oh, and we have a medical Mythbuster
hooray,
later.
Hooray!
Here on Zorba, Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. The number again, if you have a question for Zorba, 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, an FDA warning to five producers of powdered caffeine.
That's right. Powdered caffeine, which I really didn't even know existed. It turns out to be a very, very serious thing. So it's kind of interesting. A teaspoon of caffeine powder, one teaspoon, is equivalent to 28 cups of coffee.
Whoa.
28 cups of coffee. A tablespoonful can be lethal. A 3.5-ounce package, that's a 100-gram package, has as much caffeine as 400 tall cups of Starbucks coffee.
Now, this isn't something we as consumers use.
Yeah, you can buy it. You can buy
this
stuff on the net. That's exactly equal. I mean, that's equivalent to 3,000 cans of Coke when you figure it out. It's potentially dangerous, and it's being sold in tobacco shops. In tobacco shops, of all things. That's where they're selling this. So the Center for the Public Interest, which is a watchdog group, said to the FDA, you're not taking this stuff seriously. People can buy this, and they can't measure it out correctly. So you buy this powdered caffeine, and you say, oh, I'm going to put this in my drink. You know, I'm going to put it in, we'll say, a beer. Let's say you want to have a beer and you want to be hyped up. I'm going to put a teaspoon or two teaspoons in. It's, you know, it's basically like having 50 cups of coffee in your beer, and that much caffeine, it is a very toxic material when it's like that.
Is this something like students use in order to be awake for exams? Or?
Well, I think it's something
why
that
would
that
anybody
people
put powdered caffeine in anything?
Well, because they're 18 and silly, right? Because they're 18 and
so
silly.
So it is like
exactly.
A young...
Of course, yeah. I mean, how many people do you know even think about powdered caffeine? Maybe they put it on their
I've
Cheerios
never heard of
in
it
the
either.
Morning. Well, I hadn't heard of it either, but I mean, what happens is there's another issue. People think because it's available on the market, then the FDA hasn't banned it, that it's safe.
Yeah.
I mean, if you bought powdered caffeine from your local pusher who's selling mescaline and powdered caffeine, you would assume it might be toxic. But when you buy it in a tobacco store, you'd say, well, it's no different than buying a cigar or a cigarette. Now, keep in mind, they're toxic, but they're not toxic like this. This is a big issue. And so one of the companies, a company called Bridge City Bulk, has said, and they sell them in 25-kilo containers, 50-kilo boxes, which is equivalent to 50,000 servings of coffee. They have stopped selling it completely because they realize that they're at risk. There were two deaths last year, young male students who took this stuff and took it, and they died from the cardiac conditions of it.
You should take it off the market, I think.
Well, it should be taken off the market. The reality is it is a toxic drug in that amount, and the FDA should step up to the plate and say, hey, this stuff should not be on the market, or if it's on the market, it should be labeled with a poison, skull and crossbones on it, so people know it is potentially poisonous and can kill you.
800-462-7413, the number to call if you have a question for Zorba, as does this listener in Springfield, Missouri. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
Well, my question has to do with generic Accutane. About 9 months after completing a course of generic Accutane, my daughter twisted her ankle. It was what I thought would have been considered to be a minor injury. You know, teenagers heal pretty quickly, so we didn't do anything other than the usual supportive care. 6 to 8 weeks later, she's still in a lot of pain. She's a high school swimmer. She's not able to complete her practices due to the pain.
Huh.
So we had an MRI. It showed tendon and ligament damage. She went through physical therapy. Eventually, she had to stop swimming because of the pain. Fast forward 2 years later, she's finally starting to feel normal again in that ankle. And she rolled her ankle again.
2 years later. Wow. That's a long recovery. 2 years.
It is.
Yeah.
So about the same story, supportive treatment, MRI, there was a possible tear with tendon and ligament strain. So do you think that her taking the Accutane might have predisposed her to having tendon and ligament problems?
Well, I want to ask another question. Has she ever been on an antibiotic for urinary tract infection?
Maybe once.
Well, Cipro, which is an antibiotic, quinolones can cause problems in the ankle. And that's
right.
The first place I would look, whether or not she
had
that.
She's never been on a quinolone.
She's never been on a quinolone before.
No.
What do you do for a living, by the way?
I'm a pharmacist.
Oh, okay. Because you use the word quinolone in a sentence in a common way, so I just knew right away you had to be a healthcare professional, because otherwise most people have trouble even rolling it off. Well, you obviously looked up Accutane. What did you find out in facts and comparisons when you looked it up there?
Well, you know, I looked through all the different side effects because when we put her on it, you know, I was concerned initially, and they did list fractures and or delayed healing.
Mm-hmm. Was it greater than 5% or less than 5%?
You know, I don't remember the percent.
You know, I mean, one of the issues when it's less than 5% is it may be chance and it may actually be there. If it's greater than 5%, then it's unlikely to be chance. It's more likely to be that.
Right.
The answer is maybe. You know, that's listed there, so that means they're reported cases. But if it's like 1 or 2%, then it's maybe. You know, it's within that realm. Once if you know she hasn't had a quinolone, because that's the first thing that we step up to. But you know, Accutane has lots of effects. I mean, it works well for acne, but of course we know it does odd things. We know that especially young women who can't get pregnant on it because the risk of birth defects are so terribly high. We know that it has lots of side effects with dry mouth, you know, red skin, all these issues, even though it really works very, very well for acne, for that severe acne. So this is a possibility. On the other hand, there may be other things that are going on with your daughter, but 2 years is a long time for an adolescent athlete to take to recover. What's going on? How did she injure herself her second time? I'm a little bit foggy on that.
The second time she was hurrying to class, the grass was wet and the ground uneven, and she just rolled her ankle.
Okay. So then how long did it take her the second time to recover? Was it a long time or a short time?
Well, this has just happened this fall, so she's still dealing with it right now.
But it didn't recover in a week or two. I mean, a lot of college
Much longer
kids,
than 8 weeks.
You know, they sprain their ankle, they're better in 6 weeks. You know, they improve in that.
Right. Our orthopedist said that, you know, typically if you have one injury, then the second injury to about the same location is going to take twice as long to heal. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, that's, you know, what happens is once you injure it, you're more likely, you know, that you're more predisposed to injure it because the ligaments have been stretched and the tendons have been stretched. I think in my mind, if this were my daughter and it happened, I would say that certainly is a possibility. But if the literature doesn't show, because Accutane is widely used, that there are lots of with young adults with sprained ankles, then I would say that it's not due to that. I would be right on the fence with this. I don't have anything to add to that. I think it's maybe yes, maybe no. I would kind of look at this. I would treat it as an athletic injury. I would treat it as ski injury or something else. I also might tell my orthopedist, look, if she's still in pain 8 weeks or 12 weeks later, I want to get an MRI and see if something else is going on. She's a young woman. I think you've got to look at that and say, what's going on here? Is there something that we have to do? And then does she have to do a lifelong, exercises where she spends 5 minutes every day keeping her ankle strong? You know, her calf muscle strong, her gastrocnemius, and so on. So I would look mechanically on how to correct this, because you can't go back, of course, and not give her Accutane.
Right.
So good luck. Let us know what happens. We'd be interested.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate the call. Thank you. And Zorba, time again now for our Medical Mythbusters segment. Today's question is from a listener, Jane, of Pendleton, New York. She writes, "Hi, guys. If a woman does not shave her underarms, she will get horrible B.O. even though she uses deodorant."
B.O. This is such an old term. I used it in high school and elementary school.
"This is not true for men. Mm-hmm. This is something girls were taught in hygiene classes freshman year, high school, long time ago for me. I have a bunch of great nieces who dispute this very theory on Facebook, and they try to make us believe they are going to give up shaving their underarms. So, Zorba, truth or myth?"
It is totally a myth. First of all, the perspiration we get under our underarms are different. There are apocrine glands, that's what they're called. They're a different gland. Mm-hmm. Both men and women.
It's the same.
Boys and girls have these glands.
Yeah.
And they tend to produce smells that are thought to be sexually suggestive and part of the reproductive issues. They do not occur before puberty, but they are at their height during puberty when girls are freshmen in high school and boys are freshmen in high school. And boys get that B.O. Odor in the same way.
I didn't stink, and that's why I couldn't get a girlfriend in high school.
That's exactly it. You didn't have the right smell to attract those women in high school. And of course, the way to keep from producing the smell is not through deodorant, but through antiperspirant, which, of course, is what most deodorants have. They have aluminum compounds right now. And the shaving has nothing to do with it. The antiperspirants work really well.
Has a myth been bringing you down? Zorba's here to rescue you from the pits of dishair.
Oh, I love it. The pits. It's great.
Just send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
Back to the phones. A listener with us now in Cameron, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Well, my situation started in July, the first part of July, and it started on the tip of my tongue, also had some blisters in my mouth, and it was my mouth got very hot. So I Googled this, and I came up with burning mouth syndrome. And so I went to the doctor, and he didn't really even know about this. He put me on antiviral medication for 10 days, Valtrex. Mm-hmm. And that did not do anything. Mm-hmm. However, I started having other things going on in my body also, a severe saliva and drainage in my throat. Mm-hmm. My throat is constantly sore, mm-hmm. a rancid taste in my mouth, queasy stomach, and other areas, my burning buttock.
Mm-hmm. What is burning mouth syndrome? I'm not familiar with it either. What is it that you've read on the net?
My mouth burns.
I have people in my practice who, you know, their mouth burns, but I'm not familiar with it as a sort of a medical syndrome. I'm familiar with it as a not an uncommon complaint at all. What toothpaste do you use?
Colgate.
I'd get rid of it. What you want is you want to go to something like Sensodyne or another toothpaste immediately, because Colgate, Crest, and the others, not only do they have fluoride, but they have a lot of things, sodium lauryl sulfate. So one of the things then in there, and that can be a mouth irritant. And people don't realize it because you're brushing your teeth and you always feel good. It's pristine. I'm brushing my teeth. I'm doing a good thing. But there are a lot of abrasives and other things in toothpaste that can cause lots and lots of problems. So first off, Sensodyne or another toothpaste such as that. And by the way, just because it says natural doesn't mean it doesn't have all that other stuff in it to use it. And you can go to plain old baking powder, which I don't really like the taste of, but that is actually the most gentle. So that's the first thing I would do. Vitamins, you take a multivitamin?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Any other things that you take besides a multivitamin? Any complementary medicines that you take?
I take a probiotic. Mm-hmm. And I take a sleeping tablet,
Alprazolam. Okay, a prescription. I want to get on the probiotic. Why are you taking it, and how long have you been taking it?
I've just been taking it since I've had the queasy stomach that has been going along with my other problems. Yeah.
Do you tolerate dairy products, by the way?
Yes.
Yeah, the best probiotic you can get is yogurt. Live culture yogurt is a probiotic, and that's my probiotic of choice. That's what I would use.
I do that every day with my oatmeal.
Yeah. Yeah, I would have yogurt, and I would stay. I don't like industrialized products. I always worry about them. So probiotic is an industrialized product. It's not Mother Nature. Yogurt is Mother Nature. So caffeine, do you drink much caffeine?
Just maybe about 2 small cups in the morning. Uh-huh.
So what I would do, I've got a few suggestions. Number one, toss the Colgate and go to a non-sensitizing toothpaste. Give it about a month. Get rid of all the caffeine. I would not drink any caffeine at all. No caffeine, no alcohol, no probiotic. Continue with the multivitamin. And I would do that for a month and see what happens. And I would have yogurt every day and see what that does. I think you're sensitized from something. And what we want to do is get rid of the other things that can really foment sensitization, such as caffeinated products and toothpaste. That's what I would do. No mouthwash, by the way. Don't use mouthwash. That is alcohol. That's really what mouthwash is. So, thank you so much for your call. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And before we head out today, Zorba, we love it when our listeners chime in with helpful information. The following email is from a listener named Lisa, who listens on KCPW in Salt Lake City. She writes, "Hi, Zorba and Tom. I love your show. On a recent show, you were talking about sugar. I think it's important for people to know the various ways sugar is listed on food labels. Also, your nummy recipe for turkey meatloaf called for ketchup, I haven't found one without sugar. I use a pasta sauce instead. It's chunkier and works fine. And if you read the label, you can find one without sugar in it."
Good point. We have too much sugar in our food supply whenever we can do things. It's a great idea.
"I always read the back of the labels," she says, "at the grocery store. And if the list is going on long and or has items I don't recognize, I don't buy it. Just an observation. Thanks."
Great email. Thanks. Keep them coming, folks. I love them.
Have a helpful tip for Zorba? Just post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We will see you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org, or don't forget, post it on Facebook.
And you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen, and our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, expecting your company on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1230Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.